including the one that we, ISS, yeah. Now, do we really need a study group, or shall we just go ahead and do that? We've done it on every other bill in the committees I know of. Can we just go ahead and... Okay. So we...
Presentation. I'm sort of saying that is the most, the structure that you're currently having in your unit.
I am trying to project here on the screen, at the moment it's not working. But let me say that the research department did hand out the structure of the DSO earlier, and I was going to just show it on the screen again to refresh everybody's memory. But that may not be necessary if I think members have it in the document that was given to them. But just to say generally, as a quick overview, there are a number of head office divisions in the DSO, and I will go through them in a moment. And the GSO also has 5 regional offices at the moment, in Pretoria, East London, Cape Town, Durban, and in Bloemfontein. You have a document at the moment in front of you that talks about the importance of Section 28. If you look midway through that, there is another document called the DSO, a practical application of our operating methodology. It should have been handed out just now, I think, by the committee.
Still looking for the document. I would like to welcome the visitors in the gallery. We are busy with the South African Police Services Amendment Bill and the National Prosecution Authority Bill. The presentation that you are having now is from NPA.
Colleagues are still looking for this document here. Yeah, it is. The second half of it, there's another document that's stapled to it. So if you go to page 5 of that document, you'll see there's a new document. Page 6, sorry. So, Chairperson, I'll go just very quickly through this document. I'm not going to go through it in too much detail because I think members have it in front of them. But essentially, the different components in the DSO is investigators. They pretty much play the normal role of investigators. Secondly, there's what we call a Crime Information Collection Unit, or CICU for short, if you look at the diagram that the Research Department circulated. Thirdly, there's a group of analysts, we call them CAD, the Crime Analysis Division. Essentially, they work on the crime threat analysis that we will talk to later, but they also play a detailed role in investigation, helping to analyze telephone records, doing charts of who phoned whom, frequency of calls, and do various process maps as well that we often use in court during a prosecution. Then there's a forensic accountant division. It essentially, at the moment, is very small. I think, as we've indicated before, it's been a considerable challenge to try and recruit forensic accountants into the state and keep them. So the forensic accountants, at the moment, we only have about 5 people working there, and they do little more at the moment than help us to do quality control over the outsourced work and to ensure that we get good value for money from the outside service provider. But they do some operational work as well. Next is an operational support division. They essentially do support work for the investigators. So where we have a 252 operation, cooperation or permission to intercept telephones, those sorts of... Sorry, 252 is when you get permission to do an undercover operation. You know, you get permission to break the law to catch a criminal. So to sell drugs or those sorts of things. I won't comment on that. I won't comment about Lions rugby player though. they also, before the formal witness protection program kicks in, they may help with securing witnesses, and the cyber forensics division also sits in the operational support at the moment.
And
they
listen, Bulala.
Yeah, good point.
Long
overdue.
I've seen you too. And you know this sign, what does it mean? Literally. And one of you is saying this to Bulelan is saying this to Annelies.
Now, before you, can you answer, how old are you?
Each of you. How old are you?
And it's unparliamentary to say to this to another man.
Chairperson, can we just ask in which language you said that sign? Because in Afrikaans, if you say this, I say, ek is skillful.
But the Honorable Bloom said, I love you. He interpreted like that. He said, if he's saying, I love you. That's why I'm saying, is it parliamentary to say?
That's what I meant, Chairperson.
Thank you,
so, you see the necessity of having a subcommittee. There are jokes now, and I'm told in the subcommittee there won't be any jokes.
Chair, we've said quite a lot about the role of prosecutors, so I'm not going to repeat too much about that, but paragraph B is important just to stress that prosecutors do not perform investigative functions. And in paragraph 3, that essentially what we are talking about is prosecution rather than prosecutor-led and driven here, that the team is focused on what is aimed to be achieved in the eventual prosecution. The DSO also has then some operational desks in its head office. And those desks are really to deal with new and complex areas of the law. So in a racketeering case, for instance, there would be a capacity at head office that would advise prosecutors on drafting the charge sheets, on some of the legal complexities that are involved and so on. Then there is a project management office in the head office that is really geared to the DSO operates on a project management system. And essentially the PMO ensures that there are proper project plans, that there are reports on the projects. They've drawn up a training manual for that. And they are also responsible for the administration of the undercover operations, the applications for telephone interceptions, and the management of agents and informants. The SNPU, somebody alluded to that previously, that's a special national project, and that really deals with some of the high priority national projects that may be of national or international importance. Just to give you an idea of the case intake process in the DSO, it obviously only investigates matters that fall within its mandate, and we've discussed mandate extensively already. The DSO does receive complaints from individuals as well as the private and the public sector, and it may just be important to say that most of the corruption cases that are investigated by the DSO is as a result of complaints that the department concerned brought to the DSO. It's not that it goes out hunting for these cases. By and large, they are brought to the DSO by government. stress that all applications are approved at the head office level. There's a few exceptions for minor regional applications, but there's a very strict control about what cases the DSO takes on and ensuring that it's within mandate and that it is the right kind of case for it to do. The DSO, as we indicated also previously, DSO investigators do not have general police powers. They only have powers in relation to a specific case. So there will be a number of people who are designated to be part of that investigation, and they then have the DSO powers in relation to that investigation. It also happens, for example, in a joint investigation with the police, that police personnel would be designated onto an investigation, or SIU personnel in a few cases, where forensic accountants are outsourced, some of their staff would be designated as well to be part of the investigation, so they have access to the can have legal access to the information. Before an arrest is made, that a case docket is then formally registered with SAPS on their CAT system, so that it is formally part of the normal law enforcement records. And then the Kiku and CAT collectors may also supply information to the investigation during the course of it. I've already mentioned that all applications for investigations are sent to the head office, or almost all, for authorization, that they are reviewed there formally, and that they are then authorized by the investigating director, Tanda Nguyen-Nguyen. After that, monthly progress reports is given on each investigation. Just to talk a bit about the methodology then, essentially matters are investigated by a multidisciplinary team that will consist of at least an investigator and a prosecutor. They will essentially look at the early stages about whether there's a case where an investigation is warranted. Analysts are usually brought in very early, forensic accountants where required, and the other components as well. All applications for search and seizure warrants must be approved by the head office of the DSO. They are then, the usual course is that such warrants are taken to a judge rather than a magistrate for approval, just because of the number of challenges there are, as I said earlier, about search warrants. It's important that we have somebody really senior who applies their mind to it. We've talked about previously, but the prosecutors do not take part of the execution of the warrant, but they are often on the scene to give legal advice and guidance to the persons who are doing the research. And there's some examples about how you deal with cyber forensic evidence or legally privileged evidence where you need quick and on the immediate advice. We've talked a lot about the interaction between prosecutor and investigator, so I won't repeat that. We've said before that this is prosecution driven. That doesn't mean that the prosecutor is always in charge. Analysts we've talked about before. I think it's necessary then just to talk a little bit about prosecution strategy. I think one of the things that is key in the DSO is that from the beginning, prosecutors are involved in formulating a strategy for the case. A strategy for potentially how this matter will be prosecuted. That becomes very important in complex cases, both in economic crime cases and organized crime cases. It is usually necessary to make use of some of the accused to be witnesses. And it's very important that the correct people are identified early on, that you're not giving those indemnities to people who later turn out to be very senior in the organization. So the prosecutor is very key in this assessment period, because the prosecutor needs to know what evidence he would need to present the case in court. So, Chair, that in short is the methodology. Earlier, there was reference to the criteria for cases in the presentation by the research department. We've given you just a brief excerpt from the famous or infamous Circular 1 that was adopted unilaterally, and the Minister's Committee could not do so. But you will see that it tries to focus on some of the important. It's trying to say, while there's a broad legal mandate, we must refine what it is that we mean and try and have criteria to ensure that it is the more serious cases that are being investigated by the DSO. So this doesn't extend its mandate in any way. It's trying to, in a sense, narrow the mandate to focus on things that would be more serious. Just one last thing. The first document, I'm not going to take you through it, but we did get a request from the committee to say what is the importance of this interrogation under oath. What role does it play in the investigation of cases? One of our senior lawyers has written this, and there are essentially two major areas here that I think are of importance. The one is on the second page under point 2. And that is that normally you would know in a criminal investigation there's what is called Section 205 of the Criminal Procedure Act, where you can ask a magistrate to order somebody to produce certain documents. The head of the investigating director in the DSO and in these SSO type model organizations can issue such a request themselves. And that has proved to be quite important, because the process in front of a magistrate is often becomes heavily contested or long delayed through various legal challenges. So in that sense, it has been quite important. I think the rest of the document is really to give you some sense of why it is important to be able to compel people to give evidence under oath, and what the safeguards are. And I think there are essentially two scenarios. In organized crime, very often the foot soldiers do not want to be seen to be cooperating with the prosecution, or even people who know the accused. So it is useful to be able to place them under a legal compulsion. Even though they may want to speak, they are scared of looking like they are volunteering to cooperate. So many of the cases where this compulsion is used, it is, in a sense, to give people a bit of protection from those who may want to take revenge on them afterwards. But in other cases, it is very, very important. I've said already earlier, in complex commercial crime cases, a board has taken a decision, there's a written decision by a CEO. Very important to get a sense of what was the reasons for this decision. In these cases, usually the defense strategy is to wait till the end, see what evidence has been led, and then to tailor the defense to what evidence has been led. So that is the one scenario in which it is very important. It's obviously also important in scenarios where somebody may be changed, may be turned to give evidence for the state. And right at the end, we've given you a couple of examples. The Hart Bay fishing matter was a big fishing company based here in Hart Bay. The company was over-harvesting South African fishing resources to the tune of hundreds of millions of rands a year. They had corrupted large amounts of fishery inspectors. A number of their boat captains were part of the scheme. So the ability to interview, a lot of these people were charged and convicted, but then even subsequently some of them were formally interviewed, and we could use those witness statements as part of the case. So, Chairperson, that's in I wanted just to give you the numbers. I didn't have the slide on the the slide available earlier. But in terms of the actual numbers in the DSO at the moment, there's about 320 investigators. There's about 55 lawyers. And there is about 86 administrative personnel. The investigators obviously are broken down into some of those different components we outlined earlier, so we can give you a more detailed breakdown. But roughly 60% of the staff in the organization, or just over 60%, are investigators, and just over 10% are lawyers, then admin, and sorry, the senior managers. Let me not leave out Adrian here. They are 43%, 43 of the organization.
Units in total, 20 29 units are under provincial command and 4 units at national level. A further component of the broader detective service, the commercial crime component, it includes the serious economic offences unit. The commercial crime component consists of 776 members, that's 615 police members and 161 civilians. The commercial crime component is structured in 19 operational units, of which 17 are under provincial command and 2 on national level. The commercial crime component is also responsible to follow up suspicious transactions reported by the Financial Intelligence Center, as well as reports of suspected corruption in terms of the Corruption Act. I must say that these numbers do not reflect the total capacity of the SAPS in combating organized crime, as often task teams consisting of various disciplines and constituted by detectives from different provinces or units are established to address particular crimes across provincial borders. An example is a task team that was used in Gauteng regarding the house robberies. There are some 20,000 detectives in the general detective service, and the expertise and experience station detectives can be used in task team approach in respect of such particular investigations. Organized crime secretariats have been established on regional, provincial and national levels, and a process referred to as the crime threat analysis. And the organized crime threat analysis process is followed from station level to national level to eventually identify organized crime project investigations. Corruption forms an integral part or element of organized crime, and as such is being investigated within that context in the organized crime units of SAPS. Corruption which is not committed as part of organized crime is investigated by commercial crime component and, as I've said, sometimes by station detectives. The crime threat analysis process is an integration of various crime analysis findings, that is crime statistical analysis, crime pattern analysis, geographic crime analysis, linkage analysis, case docket analysis, and profiling. And activities field work, which is primarily aimed at what, why, where, who, and who of aspects of crime. The main focus of the crime threat analysis, however, therefore, is to generate crime management information for crime prevention purposes, but also to uncover criminal activities connected to groups, in other words, organized crime groups, repeat offenders and serial offenders through a process of crime analysis. The crime threat analysis follows the classical intelligence processes of planning and direction, collection, collation, analysis, dissemination and evaluation, also referred to as the intelligence cycle. Crime threat analysis is done for operational, tactical and strategic purposes. Chair, it's important that not every organized crime threat is addressed through a project. In many instances, crimes are investigated and solved through normal investigative methods without the necessity of a project being registered. Prosecutors may, in terms of the project, be prosecution-guided investigation project that you also referred to, be designated to assist with other priority matters falling without a project being registered. The detective service is supported in the investigations by the Crime Intelligence Division, which is an intelligence structure in terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act. The mandate to gather crime intelligence, however, is with the South African Police Service as an institution and is not limited to the Crime Intelligence Division. The Crime Intelligence Division supports the detective service by means of executing judicial directives for interception of communications, physical surveillance, undercover operations, and intelligence analysis products on operational, tactical, and strategic level. The SAPS is responsible in terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act for counterintelligence in the SAPS. The Crime Intelligence Division therefore performs the vetting functions in respect of all members of the SAPS, including detective service. In terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act, the SAPS may request the National Intelligence Agency to assist with the vetting process where necessary. The intelligence priorities of the Crime Intelligence Division are aligned with the investigative and organizational priorities of the SAPS as an institution. In terms of evidence-directed information analysis on operational level, a separate component of the detective service, that is the high-tech component, which uses all possible information emanating from and generated through investigations are analyzed. Those include cell phone data, information from civil society such as CCTV surveillance material, as well as information available on other police databases like the firearms, criminal records, etc. To do the linkages between different investigations and linking suspects to specific investigations. The ITech Center has been specifically successful in areas like the ATM bombings as well as cash in transit heists. The detective service is further supported by the Interpol National Central Bureau in respect of international matters and cooperation with foreign services on operational and crime intelligence matters, such as using special investigative techniques such as controlled delivery of drugs. Investigative support is also provided to detective service by the Criminal Records Center and the Forensic Science Laboratory. Operational support in respect of high-risk operations is further provided by the Special Task Force of the South African Police Service as well as the Air Wing. The commercial crime component and the organized crime component are both components of detective service together with the general detectives. The organized crime units in the province report to the provincial commissioner. Divisional commissioner detective service is in overall command of detective service, and another divisional commissioner is in charge separately for the crime intelligence division. But if we relate it to the proposal in the bill, there's a deputy national commissioner that's responsible for both crime intelligence and crime investigation, and that deputy national commissioner can, of course, be play a valuable role in terms of coordination between intelligence and detective service. The divisional commissioner, crime intelligence, in terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act, represents the SAPS within NICOC, the National Intelligence Coordinating Committee, and NICOC coordinates the strategic intelligence between the official intelligence structures, namely the National Intelligence Agency, the Secret Service, the Defense Intelligence, as well as that of the SAPS. Thank you very much, Chief.
Three, you will obviously give us a written text. And secondly, it helps to have an organogram, because it makes it easier for us to see. Thirdly, I think one of our preoccupations is, at least for those of us who are not familiar with SAPS, we're a bit challenged by the number of structures and exactly what the lines of demarcation are. And what I think we're moving towards saying, whatever we do, we want to have very clear lines of demarcation. So, you know, we don't have, even if we go for the model that has some form or another within the SAPS, we don't have overlapping mandates to the extent it's possible. And some things you can craft in law, other things you can spell out in the report. But, you know, we should be very clear about where the lines of where the boundaries begin and end. Having said that, I throw it open for, let's start with the DSO, about its structure and so on. One of the things we'll be interested in is a diversity breakdown, you know? And the question you're going to come back to us, I know Ben will get irritated, but it's necessary for the processing of the legislation, is how many people from the old order, so you can come back later on that. But for now, number of women, the ethnic and racial diversity and so on, if you've got those figures. But in the meanwhile, let's have questions from members about the DSO. Steve?
Thank you, Chair. One of the issues that is highlighted is the Section 28 of the NPA Act. And it raises...
I mean, you split it in.
Sorry.
It wasn't really relevant. We're dealing with structure.
Yeah.
I don't know where that comes in.
Yeah.
So why don't you deal with structure?
Okay.
In fact, I don't think it is appropriate for Willie to bring that in now. But it doesn't matter. We'll come back to that. Let's deal with the structure first, very quickly. We'll come back to Section 28. Because I really think we should be slightly wary of a discussion now. We need a fuller discussion later. But in the meanwhile, we'll allow you, since you slid it in, where you wasn't supposed to. The topic is the structure of the DSO. Yes, Ben?
Chair, I'm not sure whether this is allowed, and forgive me as a visitor. I'd like to ask a question of both the two agencies. What was the problem of coordination highlighted in the CAPEPE report? Was it structural or was it something else? It is very puzzling. Would you allow that question?
No, it'll be totally unfair because we spent close to 2.5 hours discussing the cause of your senior status. I think we have to respect you, Baba Chirok. We know that at your age, people are a bit slow. A meeting that starts at 10 o'clock later. I'm teasing. But Ben, it's a very good question. We didn't ask it. It's absolutely correct. That has been the key question. You've asked it in the most succinct way. To summarize it, the problem we think has been a lack of political will at the top. The Ministerial Coordinating Committee, it's astonishing. I think Kalpepe discovered hadn't met on a single occasion, though they were required to do so by the NP Act. Is that correct? Not a single occasion. Is that right? Is that what Kalpepe said? No, it didn't say that. But the sense is that we, some analysts believe it hardly ever met, if at all. Let's put it that way to be careful. It hardly ever met, if at all. It would be empirically wrong. For those in civil society who are here, I did not know. I thought Kampepe said that. It's wrong. Kampepe didn't. So I apologize for that. Now, insofar as the MCC goes, they hardly ever met. And when Kampepe presented the report, I think her point was that this MCC should meet. And obviously the cabinet was apprised of what Kampepe said, whereas we didn't know what it said, right? And the fact is, there's no excuse. In fact, there's been a suggestion, like, I think there's a general feeling about it, that we should call the ministers here and ask them why didn't they do what they were supposed to do. We disagree to the extent this is the case, but we think in some measure, probably good measure, the faults we currently have reside on the shoulders of the MCC. So that is partly it. Then there's the usual story asking about of structural issues. They are elements of a structure. How do you coordinate and so on? It's difficult. Then the officials also didn't foster cooperation. And then I think it's a more general problem of such agencies the world over. And we've seen lots of movies and TV shows and so on. It's the stuff of movies. They never cooperate. I mean, if you look at 9/11, it's astonishing, eh? Astonishing that these people who were listed came into the United States, and one agency we discovered through the U.S. Congress report wouldn't tell the other agency that, hey, these suspect characters are inside the country. But you go ahead.
If you will allow, and if you want to disallow, please do. I wonder if we could put the question to the two people who made presentations. Because you've given a summary of what has emerged in all the hearings here. If it's possible, I'd love to hear it from Willie and the other gentleman.
1 minute, because you know, it's not fair. We spent the whole morning and good part of the last 6 weeks. These issues are very much. But in fairness, because you're a veteran, we'll just allow this. Okay, first, the SAPS, in a nutshell, were the problems substantially structural or what?
Chairperson, can I just ask before I answer, you just mentioned maybe we must get the ministers here to answer about the MCC. Are we going to do that or not?
Now, you are not as elderly as Ben Chiroki, so I'm not going to cover the ground. We're going to break for tea, breakfast, and go and play in the rain, actually, is what we agreed to, and including you. You've been partnered with Annelies van Meek. So we come back to you. Okay, just allow this for once, with the greatest of respect to Ben. It's only because of his age, seniority. It's not fair. A committee spends hours and then somebody comes here.
1 minute. Chair, I think if I explained the process on the organized crime threat analysis. If I can just on that macro level. We have the police has this process which is rolled up from station level to provincial level to national level. In a nutshell, the NPA or the DSO is not part of that whole structure. So to identify your major threats and work in a coordinated fashion, it didn't fit in there. And it was also not part of NICOC where the strategic intelligence is being coordinated. I think it was mentioned over and over this morning that at a very late stage, the DSO was made or invited to attend the NICOC meetings. So I think already on a macro level, in terms of threat analysis and threat identification, there were gaps in terms of that system. Thanks.
NPA, do you want to reply? Department of Justice, do you want to reply? No. NPA?
Everybody ducks for cover. Yeah, I think the problem was probably partly structural in the sense that it was relying on coordination at too high a level rather than being embedded in lower level structures as well. But I suppose we have to be frank and say a lot of this was due to personalities over the last found that that would not happen. There was no ministerial committee. So the Scorpions in many ways had to do their own threat analysis and kind of find new organized crime markets like the Chinese and other foreign nationals operating in South Africa in which to work. So I think the situation, to be frank, between all of us has been very suboptimal in the last number of years. And I think
biggest personal rivalry has been raised 100 times as well. Having said that, Baba, Steve, on 28. All right, go ahead. I mean, really, it's not going to help, but okay, good.
No, but it's an important issue relating to the structure of the prosecutors being in the DSO and that power. And it's an important issue that we need to be aware of because there are constitutional court cases that have already been passed, and we don't want to be set back. So as we look at the model with the structures of the prosecutors and the need that has been highlighted of that Section 28 power, how will that be incorporated into a new model? You've got the constitutional court judgments already that have said it's got to be very narrowly applied and requires highly qualified legal prosecutors, I think the checks and balances. So we need to be aware structurally of how we're going to incorporate that power into a new model, particularly in view of the document that expresses the opinion that power should not be a general police power. It's a very narrow power. So my question is, how would one structurally accommodate that Section 28 power in any new model? Thank you.
Okay, Babando.
I just want to clarify on analysis. That is paragraph 6 on the DSO document. It says the analysis also provides valuable assistance to prosecutors in court by compiling organogram, chats, etc. Can be used in court. Is that what is happening now? Is that what is applicable now? What will happen if we shift it from this side to this side? The scenario that I'm looking at, where, from A to B, what will happen? What will happen to that?
Yeah, Chair, maybe this is also sort of belaboring the point, but it might be useful for the committee to have a sort of schematic outline of who's who in the zoo in the DSO. For example, there is this perception that, you know, there's this prosecutor who sort of runs everything and the poor investigator just does as he or she is told. But as I understand it, the decision whether or not to take on a new matter is taken by the investigator and the prosecutor jointly in the DSO. So it would be useful to see from the moment that a new matter is taken on, who does what at what stage of the process. Where are decisions taken jointly? When is it the prosecutor? When is it the investigator? Who ultimately decides whether or not to charge somebody? Just to get a better sense of how a matter flows.
Okay, that's it. Questions to reply. Reply questions, please. Shall we start with you, Philip?
Thank you, Chair. I think the question from Mr. Swart, I think we have the model of Section 22 and of both the Corruption Act and the Terrorism Act, which differs only in the respect that the SAPS can actually go to a Director of Public Prosecutions and use those powers through the Director of Public Prosecutions. And whilst we have it in terms of the Corruption Act and Terrorism Act, we don't have it in terms of organized crime. But I think we have the model in terms of those two sections to make those powers available, but still using the Director of Public Prosecutions or a prosecutor to exercise them. Thank you, Chair.
MPA? Chair, just to add on to that, I think that there are different ways. I think the challenge here is to accommodate those powers in the new unit or for the use of the new unit in a way that is both constitutionally sound, but also, if you read through our document in a bit of detail, you see there are also many ways of exercising those powers that mess up the prosecution at the end of the day. Because once you've interrogated somebody, you should seldom have them as an accused. So I think there are different options, but the challenge is, I think, in the new unit to ensure that one both preserves the sort of team approach to the use of the powers and use them in a legally sound way.
Other global questions?
The charts will not be lost. I think the police themselves have people who do similar presentations. It is a relatively new thing to, you know, it's been used only in few cases in the past. It's becoming more common in complex cases to do that. So, you know, I wouldn't have a fear that that is not to be accommodated in a new model. Carol's question was? Okay, well, sorry, I was going to ask my colleague here to answer the question, but then he said he thought she was understanding that we should present, do a little flow chart or something like that, so that may be more clear. I do have some employment equity numbers here with me. The technology isn't going to work right now. Essentially, African staff are at the moment 52% of the unit. White employees are 31%. Coloured are 9%. And Indian, 9%. I hope that adds up.
John, can you give it to us? Because then it's...
Yeah.
Indian?
4%
of male, is that right?
Yeah, sixth, gender is always a challenge in law enforcement wherever you go. But I think the DSO has made relatively good progress over the last years at 64% men and 36% women.
36%, I mean. Okay.
I don't want to reply. I just want to take issue on the fact that it's always a challenge. I just want to draw myself my attention to the fact that the SAPS actually received the award day before yesterday, I believe it was, as a department in the public service that's performing the best in terms of gender equality. Yep.
Thank you, Commissioner Phillips, and we're well here from the SAPS. Good. Right, over then to Willie. You're going to take us to the threat of organized crime.
Chair, we've prepared a document that I think was handed out yesterday as well, and this morning again, I believe. It is at a relatively high level, but again, I'm not going to try and go through it in too much detail. I think the general point that premise from which we move is that organized crime has proved internationally to be a significant threat.
Because we are using this, is that right? This is the guide. Everybody's got it. It is the threat of organized crime in Mongolia. Okay?
Organized crime is a particular threat, not just in South Africa, but in other democracies as well. But internationally, it's also clear that it's a particular threat in emerging democracies, particularly where you've had a recent transition to democracy. The state is often weak in those societies. There's a lack of skills, of resources, and very often of the legal weapons to combat organized crime. Organized crime, on the other hand, has massive resources at its disposal, can corrupt much of society, law enforcement, and even the state. And once it has succeeded in doing that, it becomes very difficult to turn around the state. I think one of the points that we stress in the NPA or DSO is that a focus on money has become in the last 20 years a big focus of work on organized crime. In fact, some international experts go as far as saying that it's so difficult to deal with criminals, organized criminals, and put them behind bars, that the main focus of law enforcement should be on financial disruption of organized crime. And the reason for that is that generally successful organized crime generates large amounts of money, and while the crime bosses want to stay away from the crimes and are very successful now to do that, usually the money does end up with them. And I think that is one of the biggest lessons, I think, and one that is important for what we are doing here, is that fundamentally organized criminals are operating more and more like any good business person. And that is that they look at the market, they see where there are rich returns and low risk, and that is where they will invest their money at the end of the day, or their resources. And I think for that reason, we've seen organized crime involvement increasingly in areas of economic crime, in corruption, in cyber crime, in abalone, cable theft, even in social grants, collecting small amounts of money every month, but on a large scale. And I think the important is the need for flexibility to adapt, because as law enforcement tends to deal more effectively with one area, organized criminals continue to look for other areas in which to operate. I'm not going to go too much through the next slide that just talks about some of the economic impact of organized crime. I think those figures are fairly well bandied about. There's even people who've tried to calculate what the criminal GDP is in South Africa, and there's little agreement, but I think we're probably talking about 100 billion rand or so per year, and we can't say that we're getting a lot of that back. I think one of the important things that is important to understand about organized crime in South Africa is it is not your traditional mafia style with a strict hierarchy where you have a boss and the lieutenants and the foot soldiers. In South Africa, organized crime is much more characterized by networks of criminals who may work together on one crime, work with others on another crime. Very often based on personal introductions or mutual interest. And it's relatively small and flexible groups very often. It obviously makes it in many ways more difficult for law enforcement to deal with than a very hierarchical organization. And I think it's one of the reasons there's been lots of challenge about defining what it is we mean by organized crime in a sort of scientific sense. On the next slide, just to look at some of the areas of vulnerability, illegal migration and trafficking of human beings across borders, trafficking in firearms, cross-border smuggling of illicit tobacco products, economic crimes, environmental crimes, dumping of toxic waste, those sorts of things that I've mentioned before. I think the involvement of organized crime in grey goods, the illegal import or export of goods is well documented as well. There's also an interesting development in international organized crime groups, particularly building alliances with fairly local street gangs in South Africa, that West Africans may bring in drugs, but rely largely on locals in some cases, on alliances with local groups to distribute the drugs. I think one of the... We just mentioned some of the international groups that operate in South Africa. On the next slide, I've talked before about organized crime moving into areas of economic crime and so on, but another reason for moving into more commercial activities is money laundering. It is to have a legitimate arm of their business that can justify the money that is generated. And the importance of building an aura of respectability around the operations of a person or a group. We have seen also cases in a sense where businesses, legitimate businesses, may get misused unknowingly in the sense that persons within the business get corrupted and serve as a conduit for money laundering in particular. We've even had cases where legitimate businesses are blackmailed or coerced into cooperating with organized crime groups. Mercenary activities, we just mentioned, but that is also one of the issues that is obviously a concern in South Africa. I think on the next slide we mentioned that while generally the crime rate is coming down in South Africa, it is probably not true. I mean, it's very difficult to quantify organized crime in any scientific sense, but one's instinctive sense is that organized crime is not coming down as a phenomenon. The fact that we face probably increased risks from international groups participating in crime in South Africa. The next slide I'm not going to go through. I think those are some of the indicators of where organized crime may be involved and just some of the statistical references to that. In terms of some of the global trends on the next slide that influences organized crime, the increased fading away of international borders is a significant factor. The increased international trade, free trade areas, and just the scale of international trade at the moment makes law enforcement's job significantly more difficult. Cheaper, faster transportation, better postal systems, increased low-cost airline flights, all those things are issues that contribute. And then the new technological advances are obviously very important. The next slide is just an example of high-tech, cyber-based crime and some of the international figures that we've come across. That cybercrime is now about $100 billion US dollar business. Some of the increase in computer-based attacks on legitimate systems or people's bank accounts. Then more specifically on South Africa's vulnerability to organized crime. I've already alluded to the fact that we do often have networks of locals who are very happy to cooperate. Our coast lines and borders are particularly long and relatively porous at this stage. We are on key transportation routes internationally. We've got a well-developed infrastructure, and the commodity markets in commodities produced in South Africa also poses a key risk. There are some political factors that we mentioned. The general issue of getting law enforcement to be legitimate in South Africa. I think we've made some strides over the last 14 years. But there are still parts of our society where there is some suspicion about law enforcement still. Immigration poses particular challenges. Corruption throughout our history has been a particular challenge in South Africa. Socioeconomic inequality, poverty poses its own particular challenges. I'm sure that the chairperson will be happy to hear that our analyst says that capitalist values is one of the issues that contribute to what we see in South Africa at the moment.
What do I think of that?
But Chair, then lastly, just to focus on some of the impact, some of the impact on organized crime in South Africa. I think that it does lead to a loss of public confidence in the authorities, that crime networks tend to try and use corruption of the state to function effectively, and that has become a significant factor in South Africa. The impact of organized, traditional police services or forces have difficulties in dealing with corruption. I think the idea is traditional law enforcement, not talking about police in specific now. Partly because you have the difficulties that people are usually willing collaborators and it's very difficult to get corruption convictions. Economic crimes particularly, and I think Treasury is really concerned about the impact of some of the big economic crimes on South Africa's capital markets. and that in certain of the cases the impact, the financial power of organized crime has really had a significant impact. Let me also say that traditionally we tend to talk about organized crime as the nasty men, mainly men with guns. But some of the misdoings that one sees in the corporate world would qualify by any normal definition of organized crime. And I think when one looks at organized crime, one really should not look at it only with a narrow eye. I think just some of the transitional challenges that we faced since 1994, the greater openness of our borders, the fact that during the transition some of our state structures have weakened, the increased presence of Nigerians, Russians, Chinese, Moroccans, Italians, and later on Portuguese, Indian, and Pakistani groups in South Africa. And I think the penetration of organized crime even into some parts of the security industry is a worrying trend as well. I think the last part of the document really deals with strategies and some of our conclusion of our analysts about best practices. We've covered that in our other presentations, so I'm not going to go through those again. Thank you, Chair.
Basically, obviously there are key principles that emerge. And can we just agree now? It's simple. There's a strand of thinking that says that DSO should be completely dissolved and that, you know, like its individual members should be allocated to SAT stations and so on. We can't be serious about that. We have to have a specialized unit, at the very least within the SAPS, for those who have problems with the DSO, right? So I think let's agree when we go through the line by line and we look at the clear, there are some people who say we shouldn't do that. You look at the complex, sophisticated nature of organized crime. You have to have. So the implications of this, which I think have been covered in different ways, and I think, you know, you, in your best practice slide you covered it. It's like, for example, what principles emerge for any effective organized crime unit based on the nature, scope, complexity of organized crime, the specific challenges it poses in our country. So there are some key principles that emerge, and I think in different ways we started covering those principles. The second is that it's also about the nature of defining organized crime. That's the second theme that emerges by looking at the challenges. And I think that we will draw on this quite a lot next week. And in fact, if you look at where we are in our program, we're on point 8, point 7 and point 8. So the next point, which begins on Tuesday, is deciding on the key principles, values, and goals and elements of an effective organized crime fighting. You know, then we look at the strengths and weaknesses of this corp in that regard. It's covered a lot, but we just contextualize it. And then in the context of those points, should the scorpions be retained? Not. If so, why? If not, why should they be disbanded? What exactly? In a way, that's covered also. But we'll have to now organize it as a structured thing to prepare for the modeling. Okay. Having said that, over to members about the nature of organized crime. Questions, please? Any questions? Okay, Annelies?
Not so much as a question as a comment, and I think you've touched on it as well. There is some difference between, it's not major, but I think it can result into problems if we don't address it at some point, between the police definition of organized crime and the presentation here. I think we need to...
Organized crime?
The one that SAPS use. And I think we need to find common ground on that. And maybe it's something that they can start looking at as well. I think SAPS' definition of organized crime, or the elements that must be present before it can be classified as organized crime, is in many ways, it leaves less room for interpretation. Now, we can argue what do we want. Do we want more room for interpretation, or do we want less room for interpretation? But I think that's something that we need to look at.
We've already more or less moved in some direction there. If I'm correct, our majority view seems to be that we should be both more precise and more flexible. Now, the flexibility part, how will we actually deploy that flexibility? That's where we haven't agreed, Annelies.
whether the minister and or the national commissioner and or the head of the DPCI or how we do it, but I would like to, us to think as a committee that as Parliament we must have a role in it. See, they can't just use laws that we pass to do what they want. So I think one of the overriding themes that's emerging, whatever disposition we have on this matter, is that Parliament has learned a bitter lesson. And we're not going to allow this to happen. And so we're going to be very prescriptive in the law. But it's not enough to be prescriptive if you're not going to then exercise oversight. So I think in our report to Parliament, we set out a program of oversight. We've done it on other bills. We'll say within 3 months of the new term, the committee, it has to be your safety and security committee. So I think there is a latitude we must give. You know, it's not right for justice people. We can just throw it open. You know your committee better. It's you that's going to bear the burden, mainly, of oversight. So you must decide for yourself. We can only throw ideas. But we have put in, like, a lot of bills, we say in the report, in the Child Justice Bill, I think we've done that too. We say, both in the law, in the bill, and in the report to Parliament, we say the committee must, within 6 months, do this, and within 9 months, do it. I think it's important because we have big mouths as MPs. We tackle the executive, but we don't put goals for ourselves and evolve a program around a bill. We tell the department, bring your implementation strategy. What is our oversight strategy? The two go hand in hand. So, in short, I think you're right, Annelise. I think that's the direction we're moving. But you see, I don't think members should just throw it to the officials. We should, you see, it would be useful if there is a relative consensus that we also have members take responsibility for crafting the ideas on paper so that we provide a firmer mandate. While I'm at this, Comrade Tomisile, I think we should also think about this. We're not saying to the Safety and Security Committee, let us deal with the NPA Act and you deal primarily. Well, that's how we started. But Comrade Mike is very clear. There's no boundaries here. In any case, she's been ill-disposed because of her daughter's challenges. So, similarly, can I appeal? Just think about this thing. I don't think we should have just SAPS dumped to the responsibility. I think DOG, who's conspicuously silent here, understandably because Willie Hoffman is appropriate to their role. I don't know why, but that's a matter we can discuss later. They should work together. And with due respect, I think DOG has the most Department of Justice. They have... Okay, I'm sorry about my bounty education. I think you understand. It's DOJ. Now, having said that, now, I actually think that, in fairness, DOJ, not G, have considerable experience. I mean, the biggest legislative load comes from justice. So I don't think we should have turf issues. You see, you can have turf issues until you come to Parliament. Then Parliament takes over. So we're not interested in who drafted this bill at all. We are actually, I think, are we saying this to them? We want both departments to work together and come up with a common bill. Right? When you come here and then you, when you're in the executive terrain, you can do all of those things. But this is Parliament. It's one Parliament. Two committees are working together. The bills are referred and conferred. And hey, I discussed it with Mr. Deutsch, by the way. Where are the rules? He says, actually, there are no specific rules on how you manage bills that are referred to one committee. Quite good. He says each, the chairpersons find their own dynamics. And I must say, to be fair to Safety and Security, I've been very struck by the willingness of Safety and Security, I mean the chairs in particular, to say, look, hey, there's no turf battles here. That's great. So why don't the departments also take a cue from us? Okay? Work together, and if you don't, then we'll force you to work together. Okay? Right. Sorry?
We always said that we might have to do so.
Right.
When it comes to the drafting.
Philip?
Chair, I've been working with the justice officials on this issue for the past 2 years.
Okay.
So I have no problem to this.
Right, so we don't have even discussed it, we're agreeing.
I just wanted clarity on that figure of 100 billion. I missed what it was. Was that the cost of security or was that the loss to the economy through organized crime? And then just touch
the value of what they do.
The value of?
What they do. I mean, how much they accumulate.
Is that the value of organized crime? Maybe we can just get... And then just touching on what Annelise said about the definition of organized crime. Again, an overriding principle that will come out is the degree of constitutional court cases we've already got. And when we consider models, to bear in mind what courts have already said, when we look at the definition or a model or whatever, to what degree will that then have to be tested again in courts and allow defense attorneys to find loopholes? So that's a hugely important principle I'm sure we'll agree upon, just to look at the legal implications of the model that we are drafting.
So just something, I don't know that I fully understand you, and maybe others do. Is there no way you can do like a half a page, even a bullet point document for Tuesday, and then you take us through it? Because you're quite obsessed with this thing, and I can see what you're saying, but I'm not sure that I fully see what you're saying. It'll help all of us. Okay, Baba?
In one of the slides, we talk about the flexibility of the borders in the organized crime and so on. You know that some of our borders are controlled by different people, from SAR to DOD and others and so on and so forth. In this scenario of coming up with the organized crime and so on, would you think that the involvement of the people who are dealing with it, because when you talk about globalization, we talk about flexibility of the borders and so on, and we're talking about Nigeria, Russians, and all other people that will be flexible to come and go, in other words, opening the borders and so on and so forth. Would you think that when we talk about organized crime, would you think that it will diminish the thinking of organizing themselves, or will it increase it? Because, you know, one of our assistant security, when we visited one of the countries, we were told about Africa, how Africa is organized when it comes to organized crime. We were told by 419, Nigerian 419 and so on. And we were in Brazil when we were told about that. But here, we are talking about globalization, we are talking about opening, we are talking about brother against brother, forget about the borders and so on. But here, we are talking about organized crime. Does that include the other section of the department, or the other departments? I understand about justice and safety and security, but other departments that are involved in these things, because the flexibility of borders, does it say that you come and steal what I have? If I am able to steal what you have, I will be okay too. That's what they're saying.
Good point. If I was Japanese, I'd say you've got minus 30 seconds to reply. Purpose 3. But since I'm not, we'll give you 2 minutes. Can I just tell you something? You know, Japanese companies, many companies stand and have board meetings. You know why? If everybody stands, then they're less likely to talk for too long because you get tired. I think what we should do is the committee meetings, we should all stand. I think the meetings will end at 11:30 if you start at 9:30, eh? And the chairs will talk much less. Okay, that's for sure. Okay. One other question. One chair. Okay, one chair. Correction. One chair. I wonder who we're referring to. Now, look, any other questions? Please don't. You have the right to ask, but you don't have to exercise that right, okay? I mean, it's your constitutional right. You can. Any questions, please? Good. Nobody. Okay. Great. Okay. Over then to you, Willie.
Thank you, Chair. You said you must stand up. I'm too tired already. Chair, let me start with the last question first. The issue of borders, I think we have to accept that we're dealing with more and more of a global economy, and that they are imperatives for free trade zones and open borders and those kinds of things. So we're not going to get away from that. The economic considerations, I think, tend to override everything else. But I think what we have to do is be aware of the challenges and be able as best we can to deal with those challenges. I think we very often at the moment we're not dealing with those challenges as well as we could, and the risks that come with the borders. On the criminal GDP, you know, I think the DOJ bandied some figures about that the proceeds of white-collar crime is between $50 billion and $150 billion a year. Other figures have been bandied about. So at asset forfeiture, we did try and work out what is the criminal GDP, and we failed. So that's why I said it's a thumb suck. But, you know, I think it's probably not an overly pessimistic thumb suck, but I think we must accept that crime is big money business in South Africa, as it is in most other parts of the world. I wanted just to say one thing on the definition of organized crime, and in a sense we have purposely not tried to define organized crime. There is no internationally accepted definition of organized crime, and in many ways it's undesirable because of the flexibility we're talking about. If two people come in here with 100 million rand worth of drugs, are they organized or not organized, because they're not five, you know? So you don't want... It's the same issue we alluded to earlier in terms of what we say in the law and what one may say in the guidelines that deal with the case intake of the unit. You know, the law itself, you're never going to come up with a definition in the law that caters for everything that needs to be catered for.
Just that when you come on Tuesday, can't you all do some work on a definition and come to consensus between DOG, SAPS and NPA on a definition? Can't we ask you that? Bearing in mind what we said, a measure of precision with a sense of flexibility, and ultimately Parliament having some say, because we can't just let the executive do what it wants to do. How about that? Okay, so shall we leave that to you? Okay, having said that, now on the last item on the agenda is broad principles. You'll be very impressed to know. I don't need to say very much, it's covered. It's more about process, but basically there's four models. Christine, can you start doing like a 2-3 page document? I'll help with it. In PC, where's he? Not yet. Okay, not yet, yeah. And then there's Tumisang. Where's Tumisang? He's not around either. All right, well, they can help and do this thing. What we'll try to do is send it out by Monday afternoon, but Tuesday morning when we meet, we'll have this thing on each page. Very quickly, model one, and then just say some issues you need to respond to, model two, model three, model four. So I think Parliament should do it, really, not the executive. Let us do it. And I will take primary responsibility together with Comrade Maggie to ensure, but she must see it. She's going to be here later this afternoon, early tomorrow morning. And Comrade Jumisile and I will oversee the thing. And maybe Bolalani has the work, and then we'll sort of work on it and then send it to you. It's a working document. So on Tuesday, as far as, so those are the four, what you call models. There may be a fifth model. We've agreed to have ISS and IDASA if they'll come. If ISS drops out, we can find somebody else. The next point is that on the ANC side, we are meeting at 10 o'clock tomorrow. It's quite vital. And we will decide then who comes. But the idea is that the subcommittee is open to any member who wants to come. But we would like to suggest strongly that on the side of the opposition that, you know, all of them, all five of them come. But on our side, we think of three maybe from safety and security side, three from DOG. Justice Committee. Now, we're wasting time, please, by correcting me. Now you are provoking me, but I'll be Japanese and not respond. Now, the fact is, comrades, we are required by our party to be active in the constituency. And we're not going to make any major decisions behind your back. We have no authority to do so. And by tomorrow afternoon, you will be giving us a broad mandate anyway. So it's important, JJ, 10 o'clock tomorrow, you know the venue, please be there, and then you can go. What we can think about is if everybody wants to come, nothing stops you. You know, but then we'll be a big mass meeting. Yeah, we'll have a mass meeting then. Okay, having said that, we must thank everybody for their cooperation. And we shall see you in committee on Tuesday and in the study group tomorrow at 10. Thank you. Tuesday, 10 o'clock. Yeah, there's no study groups. Lolly will let you know. It's a smaller room. No, not this venue. No. We need a more leisurely, relaxed, round table sort of atmosphere. Yeah, E305 might be an option because I don't think there'll be many of them. Yeah, it's got a round table. Yeah. Yeah, so we don't need to meet here. Yeah, Tuesday. She'll let you know tomorrow morning.